Chapter 10. Present Day. It's been 3 days since the Derby party, and the mailbox is still empty. I'm also no closer to finding out that woman's real name, or where she's from. And until I know her real name, she is nothing more than that woman to me. But just because I haven't run across her in town doesn't mean she's been in hiding. Everywhere I turn, the name Luca Marino falls from someone's lips as they recount their interaction with her. I got added to the group text after the Derby party, so I could see in real time that Sarah bumped into her at that same tea room that was suggested for our first lunch, and Beth ran into her while getting her nails done. And despite how badly Allison spoke about James at the Derby party, she and Cole went out to dinner with them last night. She gave everyone a full recap this morning. There was even a picture of James and her at the Derby party in the People and Places section of the tiny local newspaper. Her hat was looking even more dainty and refined in print than it did in real life. While I've taken my time insinuating myself into this community, she has come in like a hurricane. The level of sheer audacity on her part wasn't apparent until I stumbled over James's mom's Facebook post gushing over that woman and the homemade soup she made for James's dad. There were 128, and counting, comments about how lucky the Bernards were to have her. Since James's mom tagged her in the post, it took only one click to be on her page. Her account hasn't been active long. The earliest activity was an uploaded profile pic with the caption, "Ugh, old account got hacked, so let's be friends here," about a week after I arrived in Lake Forbing. It was the second post that confirmed it was not a harmless coincidence that she showed up in this town, with my name and details matching my own history. When I was in sixth grade, my class took a field trip to a local farm, where we spent the day playing farmer and doing chores like milking cows and feeding chickens. Somehow, that woman found the group picture we took at the end of the day and posted it as a throwback Thursday with the caption, "Look what I found while going through some old boxes. Such a fun day. Tag yourself if I missed you." In the picture, I sat cross-legged in the front row, second from the left, in my jeans and favorite red sweatshirt Mama had trimmed with navy gingham ribbon around the collar, cuffs, and bottom hem. Several people I went to school with, classmates I haven't thought about in years, tagged themselves in the post. It was a virtual reunion in the comments section, as most of them reached out to tell her they're happy to reconnect, fully believing she is me. I had gone back to that profile pic and studied it until my eyes were blurry. Her head is turned, that long hair covering most of her face. And she's laughing. It's a great candid shot. The last time those old friends had seen me, I was a teenager with baby fat still clinging to my cheeks. It's easy to see why they believe she's exactly who she says she is. If this were any other job, I would have grabbed my few belongings and gotten the hell out of town the second she was introduced to me. But the ramifications of abandoning this job override that instinct. I can't run. Not yet. Not after the last job. It has taken everything in me to maintain the level of carefree, happy girlfriend that came second nature before the Derby party, in order to keep Ryan from suspecting anything is off. A glance at the kitchen clock has me moving. I rinse my coffee cup in the sink before grabbing my bag and heading to the garage. After a lot of thought, it's time to make the call I've been putting off, but only from the privacy of my own car. While there is still a slim possibility that someone other than my boss sent the imposter here, it is very unlikely. If my boss were to find out about this woman from any source other than me, there would no doubt be serious consequences. Calling this in is what's expected of me, and right now, I need to be 100% predictable. With my car still hidden away in Ryan's garage, I open the glove box and pull out the prepaid phone, removing it from the package. It will be used one time, and then destroyed. Once it's powered on, I dial the number I memorized at the beginning of this job. The call connects, and the robotic voice asks, "Is there a problem?" With all the voice recognition software available, the true sound of Mr. Smith's voice is a secret that's guarded as meticulously as his real name. Significant development that makes this call necessary. Made contact with a woman claiming to be me. Used my original name. Stated she was from my hometown. Used details from my past as hers. Please advise. The pause is uncomfortably long. Yet you waited 3 days to report this development. Shit. Wanted to be 100% sure it was not a coincidence before. He interrupts me before I finish. I felt you needed a reminder that you are replaceable. Treat her arrival as motivation to successfully complete this job, as opposed to the utter failure of your last one. Once this job is finished to my satisfaction, you will return to being the only Luca Marino from Eden, North Carolina, in my employ. He pauses for a moment, and then adds, I know how important that is to you. If the information I was supposed to have turned over to him on my last job hadn't been extremely sensitive, I don't think Mr. Smith would feel the need to threaten me like this. I might not know exactly how badly that woman with my name and my background being here can hurt me, but that doesn't mean she can't hurt me. Mr. Smith doesn't do anything without good reason. In this line of work, being replaced doesn't mean you're let go without a letter of recommendation. Even if I don't know Mr. Smith's real name, I know enough that I don't get to just walk away. My free hand grips the steering wheel, and I swallow down the urge to scream. When I'm sure my voice is controlled, I say, I don't particularly like having a threat hanging over me, especially after all the jobs I have successfully completed. All those previous successes are what made the last failure so difficult to accept. But it also gave you a second chance. You need to remember that while you're sitting on the back deck eating Chinese takeout. Chinese takeout? What I picked up for dinner last night. I would like nothing more than to finish this job to your satisfaction. When can I expect my next set of instructions? No firm date, but within the next 2 weeks. And to be clear, this is a reminder, not a threat. If I were issuing a threat, there would be no confusion. The line goes dead. I didn't learn everything I wanted in that call, but I learned enough. I have confirmation Smith sent that woman here, and at least I now have a general time frame for my next set of instructions. But the most important thing I discovered is that even though his trust in me has weakened, I haven't lost it completely. Even though I feel like a sitting duck, I must finish what I started. It's time to go off script. I start the car and pull out of the driveway, heading to work. Once I'm on one of the busier streets, I swerve, jerking the wheel hard, and my left front tire hits the concrete curb. There's a loud screeching sound, then I hear the tire pop. The car limps into the tire repair shop at the end of the block. One of the techs motions for me to pull into one of the open bays, then moves closer to inspect my tire.
You're lucky we were close by. You couldn't have driven on it this way for long, he says when I exit the vehicle.
So lucky, I agree. I grab my purse and head inside the shop. The guy behind the counter greets me when I step up to the counter.
How can we help you today?
I roll my eyes and say, hit a curb down the street and busted my tire. I point to my car through the glass window that looks out onto the shop area. He asks for my name and information as he fills out the order ticket.
It'll be a couple of hours before it's ready. Got a few folks ahead of you.
No problem, I say, moving toward the waiting area. Digging my phone out of my purse, I call Ryan. He answers on the second ring.
Hey, what's up?
He asks. Hey, I reply, frustration lacing my words. I'm at the tire shop on Jackson. Wasn't paying attention and hit the curb and popped the tire. Luckily, I was close enough to get here before it got too bad.
You and tires do not get along,
he says with a laugh. No, we do not, I agree. He chuckles, then asks,
need a ride? I can call Cole to come pick you up and drop you at home or work. Thursdays are usually the only days Ryan is out of town, but he took a meeting with some potential clients in the town just south of here, so he's out of pocket for the day. No, I'm going to wait it out. They said it shouldn't take too long. I'll call work. I don't think they'll mind if I'm late since I stayed behind and worked that event last week.
Okay, let me know when it's fixed.
I will. I'll see you tonight. I end the call, then text my boss, letting him know what happened and that I'll be late. I move closer to the counter and tell the man who helped me moments before, text me when it's ready and I'll be back for it. He nods.
Yes, ma'am.
I exit the store and walk three businesses down to the car rental agency. The girl at the counter is young and way too perky for this early in the morning.
Can I help you?
She asks, much louder than necessary. Yes, I have a reservation for a car. Annie Michaels. She taps away on her computer and then beams at me.
Yes, we're all ready for you.
I sign the paperwork, then grab the keys to a black four-door sedan that's parked out front. Within 10 minutes, I'm on the road. Ryan has gotten into the habit of dropping by my work, so I needed to capitalize on his impromptu out-of-town meeting. But I also needed to account for my time away from my boss. And since everyone in this town knows one another, my stories have to match. As I pull onto the interstate and head west, I block out everything else and focus on what's ahead. I spent weeks surveilling Ryan's business in East Texas when I first got here. When I finally got my first set of instructions, I realized how important that business was for this job. The search of his Glenview office offered some information, but not what I needed to finish here. But that woman's arrival in town had got me antsy and feeling like I needed to go back and make sure I didn't miss anything. So I put the plan in place to head over there when Ryan told me he would be gone for the day. After that call with Mr. Smith, this job has taken on a sense of urgency I haven't felt before. He wanted to show me I could be replaced. But he also showed me that in the time between the last job and this one, he went to great lengths to groom someone to be me. It's clear there's something big I'm missing. And it's vital that I start over at the beginning and look at everything with fresh eyes. The game has changed. Chapter 11. Present Day. In Lake Forbing, Ryan runs a local branch of a national brokerage firm. It's located in one of those new office parks where the row of identical buildings looks like cottages. Most of his clients are little old ladies who need help investing their oil and gas royalty checks. He is the local golden boy whom they trust completely. I could probably match his client list to the guest book from his grandfather's funeral, name by name. In Glenview, Texas, Ryan runs a trucking and transportation business that's located in a warehouse in an industrial area on the outskirts of town. The only signage on the entire property is a rectangular white metal sign with the words Glenview Trucking stenciled in black letters. The phone number sends you straight to a voicemail system, and there is no website or social media attached to this company. He never talks about Glenview Trucking, and I believe very few people, if any, know it exists. Just as I cross the border into Texas, which is the halfway point between Lake Forbing and Glenview, I mentally retrieve that typed page of information I was given about Ryan and the business located here. Glenview Trucking was established in 1985 by Ryan's grandfather, William Sumner. William's son, Scott, joined the business after he returned home from college in 1989. At inception, the business was a legitimate enterprise that served the East Texas and North Louisiana area. It still operates in its original capacity, but in the late 90s, the business model expanded to include brokerage services for stolen goods. It is believed that currently 2 out of every 3 trucks that arrive are transporting items bound for the black market. While the illegal side of the business is vastly more profitable, Glenview Trucking is an invaluable front that must be maintained. Ryan took over operations after his grandmother, Ingrid Sumner, was diagnosed with cancer, and his grandfather became her full-time caregiver, but limited his on-site involvement to one day a week, Thursdays.
Ryan has done an impressive job of keeping the company in Texas separate from his life in Lake Forbing, Louisiana, just as his grandfather and father had done before him. Opinion based on research, but have no hard evidence to support. Ryan seems to make every effort to maintain the business his grandfather started and his father worked at until his death in 2004 in Glenview. I believe this business is immensely important to him, and he will protect it at all costs. My last job was unusual in the sense that I knew immediately I was sent to retrieve sensitive information that was being used as blackmail against Victor Connolly. But normally there is a lag between when I get the name of the mark and when I get my first set of instructions. I use that time to dig deep into every aspect of the mark's life, so I'm prepared when the time comes to get to work. While I'm waiting to see what the job is, I try to predict what the client hired us to do, even though I never know who the client is. So that's what I did when I got the name, Ryan Sumner. At first glance, the financial services business and its long client list of old ladies with their oil and gas royalty checks seemed to be the obvious answer. But the more I learned about that part of Ryan's life, the less it seemed likely. There wasn't anyone on his client list who caught my eye as the reason I'm here. There's always the chance the mark is just a means to get close to one of their friends. But it didn't take long to rule that out as a possibility either. Ryan's friends may be the type to cheat on their golf game, their spouse, or their taxes, but that's the extent of their bad behavior. But when I looked into the trucking business in Glenview, I knew that's why I had been sent here. It's impressive what Ryan has been able to do in the last 6 years. He took what was a two-bit operation and turned it into a lucrative enterprise with a reputation of white-glove service that has clients across the country. While there is still the occasional truckload of stolen Xbox and PlayStation consoles that rolls through his place, he's transitioned the business to moving more upscale merchandise and to the procurement of specialty items by request. He has become the concierge of the black market. Basically, Ryan is a thief, just like me. My first set of instructions verified my suspicions when I learned his trucking business had become profitable enough that it was targeted for a hostile takeover. Not the first time I've had an assignment like this. And while helping the client facilitate the takeover of Ryan's business may have been what brought me here, my objective has shifted now that Mr. Smith has brought an imposter on the scene. The needs of the unknown client are now irrelevant to me. I'm going back over everything to discover why Mr. Smith chose Ryan Sumner and this job to test me. Just before I arrive at my destination, I stop at an old gas station and pull to the back of the parking lot so I can change. The rental car may be a little out of place in this industrial area, but the disguise is on point. I've traded the pencil skirt and loose blouse for a worn pair of baggy Levi's, a button-down khaki shirt, and a safety vest. My hair is tucked underneath a short wig and baseball cap, while the custom-made silicone facial prosthetics turn my features more masculine. I could pass for a man on his way to work. I park in the lot for the building next door to Glenview Trucking, then walk toward the chain-link fence that separates this property from Ryan's. This is only the second time I've been here, but I've watched countless videos of Ryan while he was working here. The intel I get before making contact is always thorough, so I watched as the coat, slacks, and dress shoes he left the house in were quickly replaced with worn jeans, a t-shirt, and scuffed-up boots. In the videos, he exits the building from the office door located in the corner of the warehouse and walks to the driver's side of each and every truck that pulls up to the building. The driver rolls down his window, and there seems to be an exchange of pleasantries before Ryan retrieves a remote from his pocket to open the bay door. The structure is large enough that an 18-wheeler can pull into any one of the three oversized roll-up doors that run down the front side of the corrugated metal building. Fit completely inside so it can be unloaded in private, and then exit through doors along the back wall. My plan is to enter the enormous building the same way I did the first time I came here. There's not as much action today. From the reports, the illegal shipments only come on Thursdays, when Ryan is here to inspect them himself.
From the increase in volume over the last couple of years, he's going to need to add a second day soon to keep up with demand. The legitimate operation brings in far less traffic. Ryan has done a good job keeping both sides of this business separate, and that includes the employees. There's a skeleton crew here today, and none of these workers are ever present on Thursdays. I should be able to slip in without anyone noticing, since their guard will be substantially lower than that of the guys who are here with Ryan. I wait on the other side of the fence, near where Ryan's employees park, until a truck pulls up. Then I quickly make a small opening using a wire cutter from my belt. When a man leaves the small office to greet the driver, I slip through and walk the short distance to the back side of the building, just like any other employee would. I pick the lock quickly, then quietly open the metal door. There's only one guy inside, but he's in the back right corner stacking boxes. He seems focused on his task, so I edge my way through the warehouse toward the office that sits in the front left corner of the building. I peek through the small window set in the door to make sure the room is empty, and then slip inside right as one of the bay doors begins to open to allow the truck through. The office is a complete mess. Stacks of papers cover each of the three desks, along with empty coffee cups and a couple of pizza boxes. Thumbing through the filing cabinet seems like a better use of my time than picking through the trash. I've turned information on this business over to Mr. Smith twice now. The first time was the general sort that described the day-to-day activity and key personnel, which I was able to get from some of his files here. While that information was helpful, it wasn't what I needed to complete this job. That wasn't surprising, given that there are several employees who use the space while running the legitimate side of Glenview Trucking on the days Ryan isn't there. He wouldn't be so careless with sensitive information. The second delivery included crucial data that make the takeover possible. All the financials, including where the money is and who the clients are. Lists of where he gets the stolen goods and merchandise, as well as contacts in local law enforcement and border patrol who turn a blind eye. That treasure trove of information was retrieved from Ryan's laptop, the same laptop he keeps with him at all times. I spent weeks patiently waiting for the right moment to access it. I had found everything Mr. Smith needed to take what Ryan has spent years building, and I was surprised by the pang of regret that hit me when I thought about how huge his loss would be. It was the first time I felt bad for doing my job. The first time I wanted to give a mark a fighting chance to keep what was theirs. I've also tried not to analyze why I was feeling this way, especially since I knew how important this job was for my own survival. So even though I'm back to look through files I've already searched, there's no real expectation I'll find anything helpful. I just want at least one more look in case something new jumps out at me, given that my main focus has now shifted. The idling engine of the truck inside the warehouse is loud enough that I don't hear the approaching voices on the other side of the door until they are seconds from opening it. The small bathroom is the only spot where I can hide. I scramble into the shower stall, pulling the opaque white curtain closed just as the office door opens and two men enter. I crouch down, lean against the shower wall, and put my head as close as I dare to the curtain. From the small gap between the shower curtain and shower wall, there is a sliver of view into the office from the open doorway. The office chair closest to me is occupied, but I can only see the side of the chair and part of the man's shoulder.
Go ahead and call him in here.
His voice is like a punch in the gut. It's Ryan. Ryan is here. Not meeting clients back in Louisiana, but sitting about 6 feet from me. A door opens, then shuts, and we're left alone. I lean away from the curtain in case he heads in here to use the bathroom. This is sloppy of me, and I'm never this sloppy, despite Mr. Smith's feelings about my last performance. But if he could see me right now, I wouldn't blame him if he questioned my ability to successfully complete this job. The sound of paper shuffling is the only thing that lets me know he's still at that desk, since I've lost the visual. A few minutes later, I hear the door open again, and two different sets of boots shuffle across the concrete floor.
Hey, man, what are you doing here today?
A man's voice says. The inflection is high, like he's surprised, but there's a nervous quiver to it that gives him away. He's scared. There is no answer, so the man keeps talking as if his words are less dangerous than the silence filling the room.
I know I'm only supposed to work on Thursdays, but I needed a few extra hours this week. My ex is on my ass about money again, wants to send the kids to some damn summer camp up in Arkansas. I'm like, shit, they don't have to go all the way to the damn Ozark Mountains to play tag and whatever other bullshit they do up there.
Silence.
I'm sorry, Ryan. I know I'm not supposed to be here today.
His voice breaks when he says Ryan's name, and this has me more curious than anything else. Ryan has yet to say a word, and this man is terrified. All I've ever seen is sweet Ryan, romantic Ryan, fun Ryan. Scary Ryan is intriguing.
Come on, Freddy. Did you really think it was possible to make a side deal and have my trucks come through when I'm not here?
His voice is now a bit deeper.
No, it was dumb. Stupid. Really fucking stupid,
Freddy answers. The third person in the room hasn't spoken yet. There's a squeaking sound, as if maybe Ryan is leaning back in his chair, and the springs need to be oiled. I can almost picture him. He'd have his hands laced behind his head. Maybe his feet are propped up on the desk. He would look calm, almost casual. But the voice lets you know he's anything but.
Seth, grab those wire cutters off Benny's desk, Ryan says in a deceptively calm voice.
There's a rustling sound, and then Seth says,
got him.
And then there's an edge to Ryan's voice that I've never heard before.
You're going to tell me who else is involved, or Seth is going to enjoy using those wire cutters on your fingers.
The chair squeaks again, and Ryan adds,
what do you think, Seth? One finger for every minute we have to wait? Sounds about right to me, boss. These are pretty dull, though, so it may take me more than a minute to get one off.
Seth barely finishes before Freddy is talking. He's throwing around names and plans and dates at such a rapid rate that I hope Seth has forgotten about the wire cutters and picked up a pen and paper instead.
You're not telling me everything, Ryan says. You and those other idiots are too stupid to pull this off on your own. Tell me who else is involved.
The guy's voice cracks when he says,
that's it, I swear.
I hear the chair roll briefly, and now I'm imagining him leaning forward, his elbows on the desk, and his hands clasped together in front of him. I hear what sounds like a stack of papers hit the floor.
You think I don't know when someone has gone through my shit?
Oh, hell. This poor guy may take the fall for something I've done.
Seth, take his phone. Then get him nice and comfortable in the warehouse. Get the other guys up here. I'll let Robert know they're ready for him. Wait, wait, there's no reason to call Robert,
the guy shouts. He sounds even more terrified. From the information I found, the Robert he is referring to is probably Robert Davidson, one of his biggest customers. And from my research, Freddy and his cohort should be terrified he's getting involved. Ryan waits an uncomfortably long time before he finally answers.
You think the load you were trying to lift today was going to just appear out of thin air? You think Robert wouldn't find out his goods never made it to their destination?
His voice grows louder with each sentence, the edge sharpening on every word.
You and those fucking idiot friends of yours jeopardized my entire operation for a few grand. You didn't even know the value of the merchandise in the truck. You think you're so smart to line up a buyer in advance, but you're so fucking stupid because you made a deal with one of my own guys. I knew what you were trying to do 30 fucking seconds after you made contact with him. Shit, Ryan, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it. The other guys talked me into it. Stop talking before you really piss me off.
Ryan's voice is loud enough that I flinch.
You're not my problem anymore. You picked the wrong truck, my friend. Robert wants a few words with you and your buddies. Seth, get him the fuck out of my office.
The silence is almost jarring after the last several minutes. I've never heard Ryan talk to anyone so brutally before. It's hard to reconcile the man I've come to know with the man in the next room. He works at the desk a while longer, while I hunker down in the stall. Seth is back before long, and it sounds like he settles into one of the other chairs. I hear bits and pieces of the conversation, but it's just normal chit-chat between two guys who have known each other a long time. They talk about the Texas Rangers' chances of making the playoffs, and Ryan ribs him about some girl Seth has been hooking up with. There's a long discussion about craft beer that has me wanting to beat my head against a wall if I could do it without giving away my hiding spot. While I wait for the opportunity to make my getaway, this new Ryan takes shape in my mind. You have to be ruthless in business, even more so when you're working on the wrong side of the law. I knew Ryan couldn't have achieved such success without getting his hands a little dirty. But if I hadn't heard it with my own ears, I would never have believed he was capable of threatening to have someone's fingers cut off one by one. His methods may be a bit barbaric, but they also seem to be effective, since Freddy gave his buddies up within seconds. I'm glad to have seen this side of him. I need to know what I'm dealing with when it comes to Ryan. Finally, Ryan and Seth leave the office, and I wait another few minutes before slowly pulling the curtain open. I spot them through the window, immersed in conversation with a trucker who has pulled up. So I sneak out the way I came in, retracing my steps until I'm back to my rental car in the adjacent parking lot. I check my phone and see I have a message from the tire shop letting me know my car is ready, and another that Ryan left 15 minutes ago, telling me that he's almost done with his meeting and should be on the road soon. While I watch him, I text him back to say I'll pick up dinner on my way home from work. Less than a minute later, he's pulling his phone from his back pocket. He steps away from the guys he's talking to, turning his back on him, which means he's now facing me. I didn't see him earlier, so I'm surprised at how tired he looks, and a little haggard. His thumbs move over the screen, and a few seconds later, my phone buzzes in my hand. Ryan, today sucked. Can't wait to see you. I try to ignore what those two sentences make me feel by reminding myself that Ryan will come home tonight, dressed in the suit he left home in this morning, and lie about why his day sucked. Then I'll show him the ticket from the tire shop and bitch that they overcharged me. Even though I expect his lies, does he expect mine? Chapter 12. Present Day. I take my cup of tea and drop down on the steps that lead to the backyard. It's one of those days when the sky is so big and so blue that you can't resist being outside. Ryan flips a lawnmower that looks older than him upside down, as if he's going to perform surgery on it. What's the prognosis? I ask as he studies it. He looks up, and there's a huge streak of grease down the side of his face.
I'm calling it.
He checks his watch.
Time of death, 10:45 a.m.
I giggle and he spreads a rag over the machine as if he were covering a dead body.
I guess I'm headed to Home Depot.
Want company? I ask. And then there's that smile.
Always,
he answers.
Give me a few minutes to clean up.
He heads inside and I sit back and stare at the sky. It's been a few days since I spied on him at the warehouse, and the mailbox is still empty. There was another sighting of James and that woman last night. According to social media, they were at a local craft brewery listening to a popular local band. They have hit every hot spot in town. The hummingbird feeder that hangs from a tree limb next to the deck draws my attention, and I watch the birds flap their little wings as they dart in and out to get a drink. Every morning, Ryan refills that feeder just like his grandmother probably did. Mama would have loved it here. We spent many nights dreaming up the fantasy house we'd one day build. I used to think she just hated the trailer, or was embarrassed by it. It wasn't until I was older that I realized Mama wanted more for us than just a bigger roof over our heads. She wanted a different way of life, one where you didn't worry about having enough grocery money, one where she wouldn't worry about what would happen to me once she was gone.
Ready?
Ryan asks from the patio door.
Yep.
I glance once more at the birds, then hop to my feet, following him back inside to the kitchen door that will lead us to the garage.
As we slowly wander down the aisles of Home Depot, Ryan studies each mower, then checks reviews on his phone before narrowing it down. I'm going to look at the plants, I say, after he has stared at the same three mowers for 20 minutes.
Grab a buggy. We need something for the front porch.
He tears his gaze away from the machines in front of him and looks at me.
Maybe some ferns?
The ones that hang? I ask. He shrugs, then nods, letting me know it's my decision, because in his mind, it's my house too. We are the epitome of a domestic couple. All we're missing is a couple of Starbucks and some hand-holding. The garden section is an oasis in a sea of tools, lumber, and electrical supplies. I take my time, passing trays of geraniums and petunias and pansies, and think about what I would add to the flower beds in the front yard if it was truly mine to do with as I wished. As if I would be here to see them in full bloom. Distracted by the prettiest pink hydrangeas I've ever seen, my cart clips the side of one coming from the opposite direction. Oh, sorry. And then I nearly freeze when I see it's James and the woman pretending to be me.
Oh, hey,
she says.
I think we met at that derby party.
I hope the smile that spreads across my face hides the internal eye roll at her words. Nodding to them both, I say, yes, of course. Could she not know who I really am? That she was sent here as some threat to replace me? Because she's good. Really good. There's not a flick of recognition, nor a long look that sizes me up as her obvious opponent. There is a chance she's still in the waiting for information stage of her job. But does she not find the unmistakable resemblance between us as jarring as I do? Even though my hair is darker, it's uncanny.
Dad usually freshens up the beds for Mom, but he's out of commission right now, so we thought we'd do it for him since it's such a pretty day,
James says, nodding to the plants in his cart. Aw, what a good son, I say, my back teeth grinding.
James, hey man,
I hear Ryan say from behind me. He jogs up and the two of them shake hands. Then Ryan nods a greeting at the woman.
Luca.
He looks at her, then back at me, before once again looking at her. He sees the similarities too. Ryan clears his throat, then turns back to me and says,
I picked one and they're bringing it to the checkout in here. Thought I'd come help with the plants.
James laughs.
Damn, when did we get so old that a beautiful spring day meant yard work? We should be on the lake, icing down some beer. Yeah, no kidding, Ryan says.
But I know if given the option, we'd still leave here and spend the day in the yard, saving the lake and beer for after the work is done.
Another time, James says.
The small talk lasts a few more minutes while she and I just watch each other. They start to move away, but I put a hand on James's arm, stopping them. I was just thinking, do you two have plans for tonight? I glance quickly at Ryan and then back to them. She's been dancing just out of my reach for too long. We'd love it if you came over for dinner. She beams at the invitation.
We'd love that,
James answers for them.
What can we bring?
Nothing. We've got it.
I look at the woman.
Can't wait.
Alias, Izzy Williams. 8 years ago. This is the first job where my fake name and background has the backup to support it. I even Googled my new name, Isabel Williams, Izzy for short, and found that I was listed as a member of the cross-country team who competed at state for a local high school a few years ago. Somehow, the picture that accompanied the article included a grainy group photo, and I could swear I was the third girl on the right, complete with short blonde hair, like the wig I'm wearing right now. It makes me wonder how many people Mr. Smith has working for him. Not just people being sent on jobs like me, but those working behind the scenes, altering images that show up on internet searches and creating identities from thin air. The only other person I've dealt with is Matt. But it feels like whatever this organization is, it's much bigger than just him and Mr. Smith. There was a lot to do to get ready for this job. I was given instructions on how to pull my natural hair up and secure it under the wig so that there was no chance any of my strands would be left uncovered. I was also told to apply a thick layer of liquid bandage to the tip of each finger, so no matter what I touch while I'm here, I wouldn't leave a fingerprint behind. I'm to reapply it every couple of hours. I rub my fingers together, still trying to get used to the lack of feeling there. I added the contoured makeup and colored contacts on my own. Mama taught me how a few strokes of powder can change the shape and look of your entire face, although I know she would only have wanted me to use those tricks to enhance my face, not to make it unrecognizable. It's the first day of my first job for Mr. Smith, and I have to admit, I'm a little nervous. As far as Greg and Jenny Kingston know, I'm the new nanny for their son, Miles. But in truth, Greg has something in this house that my boss wants, and I'm here to get it for him. There were a lot of instructions of how to handle items as well. The second I retrieve the item I'm sent for, I am to drop it at a pre-designated spot as soon as possible. It's harder to get caught if you aren't in possession of what you stole when they catch you. Walking up to the front porch, I smooth down my shirt and shorts before ringing the doorbell. Greg opens the door immediately, as if he has been waiting for me to arrive. He's wearing a gray suit with a darker gray tie, and his hair looks like it hasn't changed since he was a young boy. Short and combed to the side, not a strand out of place.
"Isabel Williams?"
he asks, then looks me up and down. I'm dressed exactly as instructed, khaki shorts that hit 2 inches above the knee, and a pink polo shirt. I look like I'm ready for a round of golf. My hand reaches out for his and we shake.
"Yes, sir, Mr. Kingston. You can call me Izzy."
He nods and gestures for me to come inside. He checks his watch for the second time since he's opened the door, then yells toward the wraparound stairs that curve up the foyer wall.
"Jenny, she's here."
Both of our gazes are trained on the upper landing as we wait for Jenny to show herself. She doesn't. Greg booms her name out again, and again we wait. He's irritated and slightly embarrassed.
"Excuse me one moment," he mutters.
And then he's gone. Taking the steps two at a time, he is out of sight within seconds.
"Are you the new babysitter?"
I spin around to find Miles behind me. He's in the middle of a doorway that leads to the dining room, then eventually the kitchen, according to the blueprints I studied. Moving toward him slowly, I stop when I'm a few feet away and squat down until I'm on his level.
"I am. My name is Izzy. What's yours?"
I ask, even though I already know his name and just about everything about him. Matt gave me a packet that covered every detail about this family when I agreed to work for Mr. Smith. Miles is 5 years old, an only child, and I'm the fourth nanny that he's had already this year. His thumb pops back into his mouth as soon as he tells me his name, even though he looks a little too old for that. I point to his shirt. "Iron Man is my favorite." He pulls his shirt away from his body to look down at it, as if he needs a reminder of what he's wearing. It's a shirt with all the Marvel characters in their fighting stance poses.
"I like the Hulk. He smashes things," he says, then adds the growl and fists his hands.
I'm about to ask another question, but there's movement on the stairs that draws our attention. Greg has located Jenny and is now pulling her down the stairs. She almost stumbles once they clear the last step, as if she's unaware there are no more in front of her.
"Izzy, this is my wife, Mrs. Kingston."
His grip on her arm seems to be the only thing keeping her standing. Jenny looks at me and smiles, but it doesn't reach her eyes. Another thing I know, Jenny likes her Xanax in the morning, her Chardonnay in the afternoon, and a vodka or three in the evening. I reach out my hand and she clasps it with both of hers.
"Izzy, it's so nice to meet you."
She holds on to me longer than is comfortable, and thankfully Miles moves closer, causing her attention to switch to him.
"There you are, sweetheart. Did you get your breakfast?"
Miles nods, but doesn't say anything else.
"Right, okay, I've got to get to the office," Greg says,
then turns to me.
"You are in charge of Miles. His schedule is written out and taped to the fridge. My number is on the bottom. He can give you a tour of the house and show you where everything is. I'll be home by 6.
He ruffles Miles's hair and spins toward the door.
There's no goodbye to Jenny, or even a look in her direction. The three of us stand awkwardly in the foyer for a few seconds, until Jenny leans down and kisses Miles on the cheek, gives me a great big smile, and drifts back up the stairs.
"Want me to show you around?"
Miles asks.
"Yes. Give me the grand tour,"
I say, as I follow him through the door he came through earlier. Mama used to say I would recognize the life I was meant to have. I look around this house and think about what it would feel like if this identity were real, and I was Izzy Williams, college student and nanny to Miles Kingston. One thing is for sure, this is definitely not the life for me. 5 days down, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for. What I have found is that Miles runs this house. He knows when the housekeeper arrives. He knows where the petty cash is kept so she can pick up the week's groceries. And he knows when Jenny moves from pills to pours. When the wine flows, so do the tears, and we make ourselves scarce. While she's melancholy when it comes to Miles, Jenny is almost vicious when it comes to me. She's all smiles when Greg is around, but the second he leaves, her claws come out. She doesn't want me in her house, doesn't want me spending time with her son, but she's too drunk and high to change either of those things. Miles and I play with Legos, we build forts, we sing songs, and I search and search and search. Not gonna lie, this job gets harder each day, because as soon as I retrieve what I was sent here for, I'm gone. And who will take care of Miles? But it's dangerous to think like that. So every day I add a brick to the wall inside of me that will, I hope, seal myself off from this blonde-haired, blue-eyed child who is way too old for his age. On day 8, I'm able to get inside Jenny's bedroom. Finally. I don't have access to this part of the house often, since this is where Jenny spends most of her time. Whenever she ventures out of her room, Miles sticks to me like glue. Right now, Miles is napping, and Jenny is soaking in the bath, a thin door separating her from me. Does she stay in there for hours? Is it a quick rinse and out? Who knows? But I can't afford to lose this opportunity just because I don't know what to expect. I wander the room, giving everything a critical eye. I'm looking for a flash drive, one exactly like the flash drive in my pocket that I'll leave in its place. There are tons of places something that small could be hidden. I have looked in every drawer, nook, and cranny in Greg's office without luck. I'd dig through his sock drawer if that's where he hid his valuables. I'm beginning to think that just because the blueprints don't show a built-in safe, they might have added one after they bought this house. So now I'm on the hunt for that because I don't want to fail on my first job. Several pieces of Jenny's jewelry are scattered carelessly across the top of a delicate antique desk. These pieces are exquisite, and I'm mentally removing the stones from the settings while calculating the price each would fetch. But that's not why I'm here, so I force myself to walk away from them. I open drawers and rummage through every part of the room. It's big enough that there's a sitting area tucked in a corner near the door that leads to the bathroom. Inching into that space, I stay perfectly quiet while I listen to Jenny sing off-key in the tub. The framed family portrait of the Kingstons hanging on the wall depicts a perfect little trio that doesn't reflect what life is really like in this house. I'm sure Jenny shared this picture on social media to make everyone believe things are as rosy as that image suggests. I tug on the corner of the frame, just like I've done to every other piece of wall art in the house, and stop myself from celebrating when it swings open, revealing a small safe set into the wall. I pull on the handle, but it's firmly locked in place. Staring at the 10-number keypad, I start to sweat. There are a lot of things I can do, but cracking safes is not one of them. I pull out the phone that Matt gave me for emergencies only. This is an emergency. Luckily, he answers on the first ring.
What's wrong?
Nothing, I whisper. I found a safe. It's got a keypad and I don't have a lot of time. What do I do?
Take a pic and send it to me.
I do as he asks and then wait for him to get it.
It's simple. Doesn't look like it's hooked up to a system. Try a 4-digit number and see what it does.
I punch in 2580,
because I read once that is the most common passcode, since it is the only 4-digit vertical combo. One beep, and the little light flashed red once. Matt is quiet on the other line for a few seconds, then says,
"Try the kid's birthday."
I read all the important dates from the packet they gave me before I started, and have no problem retrieving the exact number from memory. I press in 1017. October 17th. One beep and two red lights.
Shit,
Matt spits out from the other line.
I bet this is a 3x wrong, you're locked out for good system. It probably resets after a certain amount of time, maybe 24 hours. Stay put and try again tomorrow.
And the line goes dead. I deflate. I need out of this house. Splashing from the bathroom makes me freeze. Then I hear Jenny singing that same stupid song she's been singing for 2 days. The water turns back on, probably because she's been in there so long it's gotten chilly. I stare at the keypad as my mind scrolls through the important dates and numbers from the Kingston file. Then I think about Greg. I can tell he loves Miles, even though he's not a hands-on kind of dad. He'll text through the day asking how he's doing, and seems generally interested in talking to Miles when he gets home every night. The code isn't his birthday, though. Jenny lets out a loud laugh. I can only imagine what's going on in there while she bathes alone. Why hasn't Greg booted her out of this house by now? He's obviously got enough money to hire all the help he needs. He only talks to Jenny when he has to, although there are times I find him watching her with a sad expression, an expression that shows there's still love there, even though he hates what she's turned into. Could the code be her birthday? Their anniversary? Greg tries to hide it, but he sleeps in the guest room every night, and there is only one picture beside the bed. It's of Greg and Jenny. They are young and all smiles, their faces squished together, cheek to cheek. Behind them, the sky is full of fireworks. There's a good chance this picture was taken on their first date, at the 4th of July picnic at the country club. I stare at the keypad, hold my breath, and type in 0704. There are a few seconds where nothing happens, and then the light blinks green, and I hear the lock slide open. My breath lets loose, and I almost scream for joy. I did it! I pull the door open, and the only thing inside is the red flash drive with the blue cap, just like the corrupted fake in my pocket I will leave behind in its place. It will also make whatever computer he inserts the replacement into useless. While Greg will freak out and wonder what went wrong, he should be oblivious a swap was made. As I'm making the switch, Jenny laughs again, but it's closer than before. She's out of the bathroom and staring at me.
I've been watching you snoop around my house for the last week. Her words are slurred, and her eyes are half closed.
A puddle forms on the hardwood floor from the water dripping off her naked body, visible through her open robe. This is bad. Very bad. She has caught me red-handed.
It's not what you think,
I say. She sways and lets out a shrill laugh.
Of course it is. It's exactly what I think it is.
Jenny lurches at me, her hands out as if she's either going to grab me or strike me, but her foot gets tangled up in the sash hanging from her robe, and she's going down before I can catch her. Her head hits the floor with a loud crack, and a thin river of blood runs from under her blonde hair. She's out cold.
Oh, shit,
I whisper, dropping down beside her. My fingers press against her neck to check for a pulse. I call Matt again.
I've got it,
I say as soon as he answers.
But the wife caught me. She's drunk, tripped and fell. Her head is bleeding.
Is she dead?
He asks in a quiet voice.
No, but she needs help. Should I call 911?
So she can tell the cops she caught you stealing from them? Matt spits out. Get the fuck out of there and bring the drive.
What about Miles?
While there is no love lost between Jenny and me, that little boy deserves better.
Get out of there now. You can't be caught there like this. Kingston doesn't have shit to go on if you're gone.
Matt screams so loud it echoes in the room.
Get your ass out of that house.
And then the line goes dead. I'm scared to touch her again. Can I leave her like this? Can I leave Miles? But if I stay, I could go to jail.
Chill tells them I was robbing them. They may even blame me for her fall. Chill say I pushed her. I pull the other phone from my pocket, the one Greg calls to check on Miles, the one that is only powered on once I step inside the Kingston's house.
Hello?
Greg answers.
There's a problem. I came upstairs to tell Mrs. Kingston I have a family emergency and that I need to leave immediately, but she's unconscious on the floor. She must have fallen. Miles is asleep on the couch in the playroom. You need to come home. I have my own family emergency, so I can't stay.
Wait.
But I've already ended the call. I drop the fake drive in the safe, then close it before swinging the picture back in place. Miles is the only reason I'm risking myself like this. Greg can call 911. He can come home and deal with this. I have to trust the fake name, the steps I've taken to hide my identity. I race down the stairs and peek in on Miles one last time. His little face is lost in sleep, and the origami swan I taught him to make, just like Mama taught me, is clutched in his tiny hand. He'll be fine. His dad will be here soon. He's not my problem. I dart out of the back door and creep along the side of the house until I'm on the street and jumping into the car Matt gave me to use for this job. As I'm exiting the gated neighborhood, an ambulance squeals past me, followed by a cop car. I keep my head down and drive the speed limit. Will they pull footage at the guard's gate? Have a pic of me in this car? How soon before the cops start looking for me? It takes 10 minutes to get to AAA bail bonds. I was told to never come back here, but this is obviously not a normal situation. Matt is pacing the street, waiting for me. My door is ripped open before I come to a complete stop.
What the fuck took you so long?
He pulls me out of the car and into the building. We don't stop until we get to his office.
I got here as soon as I could,
I say, as I hand him the drive and then place the phone I used for my calls with Greg on the desk. I don't mention my call to him. The call I deleted from the log just before I powered it off, in case he checks. I wonder if Miles woke up and found her before his dad got there. No, I can't think about him. Matt has the drive in his palm, and he's tapping away on his phone. He reads whatever's there, then flinches when his phone rings.
Yes?
He looks at me, his eyes boring into mine, then passes me the phone. I hesitate for just a second, then take it from him. Hello? I whisper.
Give me the events of this afternoon. Do not leave anything out.
Mr. Smith's disguised voice hides the anger his real voice would carry. I tell him everything, including how I figured out the code to the safe. Everything except the call to Greg.
You're feeling guilty over leaving Jenny Kingston bleeding on the floor.
It's not a question, but I answer, yes.
It was only a matter of time before that was going to happen. If not today, then tomorrow, or the next. She's been working in that direction for a long while.
I'm quiet. While that may be true, I can't help but think it wouldn't have happened today if I hadn't been in her room, rummaging through their safe. She would have come out of the bathroom and sunk into her bed, just like she did every other day I was there. So if she is successful today, then that's on me.
Yes, I know, I answer him.
You got the job done, but you were reckless. Taking a chance with the safe, letting that drunk sneak up on you. You're better than that.
And he's right. I am better than that. I should have noticed that she stopped singing. I should have heard her clumsy footsteps cross the bathroom floor. I should have heard the turn of the knob on the door.
What would you have done if she hadn't fallen on her own?
He asks me.
I don't know,
I answer quickly. And that's the truth. What lengths would I have taken to ensure I got away? I guess I'll never know.
I'll answer that for you. You do whatever you have to do to save yourself and the job. Because never forget, this is a job. You are not a part of that family. That is not your life, not your world. You're a ghost who drifted through it for a little bit of time. Those people don't give a shit about you, so don't give a shit about them.
I'm quiet as he continues to unload on me. His words are like a knife to the chest.
I watched you for a long while. You got as far as you did on your own because you are resourceful and can think on your feet.
You also have that natural intuition that can't be learned. Those are gifts. Gifts you almost squandered today. I understand you felt the need to call Matt for help when you found the safe. But calling is a last resort. Asking for help becomes a crutch. I need people who can problem solve without outside assistance, because aid isn't always available. That woman slipped up on you because you were more worried about rushing the job and leaning on Matt for help. You should have taken a step back, done research on the safe, determined how to get in without the code. Not break your identity by making a fucking phone call while his goddamn wife was soaking in the tub in the next room.
The obscenities seem more vulgar coming from the mechanical voice. It's not the pep talk I expected, but surprisingly, it was the pep talk I needed. And he's absolutely right. I was rushing the job. I didn't want to spend another day getting more attached to Miles. Going forward, I have to do better. I will be better. This was a tough lesson to learn. It's crushing for him to lay the truth out like that. Even though I will remember Miles and this job for the rest of my life, he will no doubt forget about me. But Mr. Smith is wrong. I'm not just a ghost who passed through the Kingston's life. I am a ghost passing through my own life. The only one who cares about me is me. The only one who is going to make sure I survive is me. I am on my own. He finally says,
money will be transferred to your account for the completion of this job. Instructions for your next job will arrive within the week. Take a few days to pack your things, since your next job will require relocating. I can't risk you running into the Kingstons.
Yes, sir.
The ambulance has already taken Mrs. Kingston from the residence, and the police are questioning Mr. Kingston as we speak. Next time I ask you to tell me every detail, don't leave a single fucking thing out.
I take a deep breath and hold it until there's a slight burn in my chest, and my head feels a little fuzzy. Letting the air out in a quiet whoosh, I whisper, I'll be better. No mistakes. Silently, I add, and I will never get attached on the job again.
No mistakes,
he repeats.